result, I don't feel any part of the debate. But that's not the only factor involved here. One of the other factors involved is the immaturity of the guts and the neutral pH. And that changes someplace between 3 and 6 months. Okay. So after about 6 months, it's pretty safe because the organism will not grow in the gut. The official line for public health purposes and so on is 1 year. And some bottles of honey will actually say 1 year, but some of them will take it all the way out to 5 or 6 years. And I've seen that one that would be 10 years of age. In those extreme settings, it's not something that they know more than anyone else. It's just lawyers say, no, don't worry about it. Just we'd be on the safe side. Have our label say that, you know, we have to be 10. But clearly, a year is a reasonable determination. And again, it's not secretory IgA that we're concerned about in that setting. It's true secretory IgA doesn't get cell levels of the body. But the factor is involved in the pH of the gut. So that should be fine after about 6 months, and so if we say a year, we're in the safe side. Okay, I thought I'd just clarify that. We had talked about hepatitis, and we mentioned the various kinds of hepatitis. Hepatitis A means inflammation of the gut, inflammation of the liver, and as a result, we have many kinds of those. We talked about potential reactions to chemical compounds, drugs can do this, pharmaceutical drugs, but also anesthetic agents and so on, the chemical hepatitis. Viral hepatitis, there are many forms of viral hepatitis. Mononucleosis is a form. We mentioned that Epstein-Barr is a virus that triggers B cells to divide, creating a wide variety of unusual antibodies. And we'll allude to that when we talk about the immune system a little more. But in that setting, it's a B cell mitogen. Remember, microplasma was a T cell mitogen. Sounds like a test point, I think. Epstein-Barr is a B cell mitogen. And it says unusual antibodies that we actually diagnose the patients with mononucleosis, so-called monospot test. We're looking for what we refer to as a heterophile antibody. Heterophile antibody, antibody to guinea pig tissue and horse tissue. Something typically you have not been infected with. Never been infected with horse. So as a result, we use those as markers of this lymphoproliferation, this stimulation of B cells to the body, creating plasma cells, including antibodies and so on, independent of any antigen. So we don't look for an antibody that's been barred, but we look for that unusual heterophile collection of antibodies. Hepatitis A and E are associated with water, food, so therefore they fit in with the GI tract agents. When talking about a virus, its virulence factor, if you want to talk about something like that, would be its ability to bind to our cells. So receptor site matching would be the virulence factor between the viruses. And receptor site matching of A and E allows it to affect the gut. We'll talk more about A and E a little later. And also hepatitis B, C, and D, these are the collection of hepatitis viruses, which is family name hepatitis A. But they're really some of the RNA viruses, some of the DNA viruses, it's just a crude collection. Anyway, these viruses, B, C, and D, are spread by blood and blood products. They're sexually transmitted. So A and E are water and food. Okay. And again, we'll get to much more about hepatitis in due course. Wound infection. A common enough problem. We see wound infections from that of a minor paper cut to places where we have to amputate body parts, to the point of people dying from wound infection. So there's a wide range of outcomes from a wound infection. Broad categories of etiological agent, and etiological agent is the agent that causes the problem. A wide range of etiological agents, aerobic, facultative, anaerobic organisms, all of which can use oxygen. Remember, the facultative anaerobic can use oxygen and fermentation. So aerobic respiration and fermentation. Whereas aerobic separation. And then the second category would be the anaerobic. We break them down that way because of the the environmental conditions of the womb site that can influence who can grow. Of the groups that are aerobic or pathogenic anaerobes, we have several. The first two are gram-positive. The next three are gram-negative. Remember our discussions about gram stain of these organisms, you should be familiar with them, because as you recall, a gram-positive organism cell wall is different than the gram-negative organism cell wall. And the lipids in the gram-negative cell wall, the lipopolysaccharide and so on, make it so that some antimicrobial agents cannot penetrate. So knowing what gram reaction we're dealing with can begin the drug of choice selection. You can start excluding things or including things depending upon the gram reaction. So knowing that is an important bit of information. Staphylococcus aureus is a first organism. Staph aureus is a gram-positive cockle-shaped organism in clusters. The word staphylo means grape-like clusters. We can have a wide variety of staph infections in this type of wound area. Let's start with a very simple thing. A pimple, a boil, a carbuncle, a furuncle. These are all names for local abscesses. So our first kind of lesion here is a local abscess. Staphylococcus aureus has an extensive interaction with bacterial viruses. As a result, it has quite an array of possible exoenzymes that can produce, depending upon its history, the actual isolate history of interaction with viruses. So it can pick up virulent infections. Some of these are much more commonly seen, so we'll get to those first, and then we'll add on the extras. So the base, so to speak, the base exoenzymes would be such things as coagulase. Now, coagulase is an important virulence factor in the sense that it allows the organism to cause plasma to clot, thereby creating an abscess. If it does not have coagulase, then it cannot cause abscesses. So our first approximation of is this a bad guy or a good guy, is this a potential pathogen or not, is does the organism produce coagulase? It's such an important factor that we often use the term coagulase positive and coagulase negative staph aureus. And the coagulase negative variety is not particularly highly virulent. And it's much more akin to the kinds of problems associated with a reasonably low virulent form of staphylococcus, and that is staphylococcus epidermidis. So staphylococcus epidermidis is found on our skin, typically not a serious pathogen. And coagulase negative staph aureus, likewise, is not a serious pathogen. So although we do have a classification of human species, staphylococcus aureus and staphylococcus epidermidis, our main focus is, okay, does it produce coagulase? Can it cause plasma to clot? So coagulase negative staph aureus is going to be dealt with in the same manner by our body and by our medical approach, as we would staph epidermidis. Coagulase negative staph aureus and staphylococcus epidermidis are very low virulent dependent organisms. The patient's got to be really immunocompromised. There's got to be something unusual going on for that organism to cause a problem. Unusual things do occur. For example, if someone has an indwelling catheter, they have a needle of some sort implanted into their body part someplace. Maybe the femoral artery stripped down or something like that, or maybe they just got an IV going in their arm, and it's not maintained properly, and now we have this opening into the body, we're getting organisms from the skin into the bloodstream, and then we see a coagulase negative staph aureus or staphylococcus epidermidis in the bloodstream of this patient. But they're really pre-immunocompromised, leading us to see that as well. So we put those aside. Those are not going to be major problems unless we have a person really in the compromise. Now, the vast majority of Staph aureus are, in fact, coagulase positive. And as such, they will cause plasma clots, and they will then cause an abscess. Think of it as a pimple. It's an abscess is a localized, walled-off area. What is it all walled off from? Well, it's walled off from our blood supply. Why would the organism do that? Because the blood supply contains our immune system. So it's protecting itself from our immune system, from our plasma clot. Now, Staphylococcus aureus is commonly a yellow kind of color. So if you were, wouldn't be you, it would be your roommate, but if your roommate is in the habit of squeezing their pimples, out comes a yellowish kind of ooze. The pus of that ooze, the thickness, the viscosity of it is associated with phagocytic cells, okay? Most of which have been killed by exoenzymes produced by the organism along with this wall-off abscess. The yellow color of that is the organism. So that yellow paste kind of thing, that yellow color is the organism. It produces quite commonly a yellow pigment. Now that, so you scrape it off with your ears. Anyway, so we've got this idea, we've got this walled-off area. And once it's walled off, there have been trapped inside, like I was inside the parking lot, trapped inside that walled-off area, our phagocytic cell. And so now the organism then begins to produce a whole series of exoenzymes. And we don't know exactly what it does, we call it a mesotoxin. If we know what it does, then we know the enzyme substrate situation, so we call it exoenzyme. So producing exoenzyme and mesotoxin to destroy specifically white blood cells. I'll give you the name of two, but there are many. Leukocytin, that's an easy one to remember. It's killing white blood cells. Leukocytin. Leuko means white. Leukocytin. Cytin, killing. So leukocytin is one of those exoenzymes, killing white blood cells, phagocytic cells, polymorphic nuclear cells, for example, pus cells, or dead phagocytic cells. So we have now one, and another one is one that will harken back to our chemistry because of its target. It's a sphingomyelinase. Sphingomyelinase. And you probably know sphingomyelin and those kinds of compounds when you talk about lipids and phospholipids and what. So, sphingomyelinase, which attacks the membrane of white blood cells, particularly phagocytic cells. So we have this walled-off area, and then we kill the organism, kill the cells inside it. So now everybody is really happy, and the fort has been sealed, and they're protected from the wild immune response, and everything is really happy. So now the organism begins to grow. And it goes lag, and long, and stationary. As it consumes all the nutrients inside that little area, and pretty soon it decides that it's going to go into a death phase, so something has to happen, and so we have to enlarge our little abscess. So now we have to have an enzyme to break down the wall that we created if we were the organism. Okay? And that enzyme is called staphylokinase. Yet another enzyme. Staphylokinase. An enzyme that breaks down this clot that was created. And the coagulase causes plasma to clot. So now we're going to break down this clot. One of the early interesting races in the biotech field was to isolate that particular enzyme, the clot-busting enzyme. As it turned out, although it's first discovered here with Staphylococcus aureus, staphylokinase. The race was actually picked up by a competitor who isolated an enzyme from a strep organism, and they called that one, of course, streptokinase. So we had two competing industries trying to develop a recombinant DNA product. For technical reasons, and not anything to do with the action of the enzyme, for technical reasons, the staphylokinase people won out and so the drug that is used as the clot-busting drug that runs $500 or more is given in cases of recent, as in minutes or hours before the myocardial infarct, in which we have a clot in the coronary arteries and so on. So we can, what we can do then is inject this enzyme into the blood vascular system, and we can then divest this clot and allow blood to flow past that clot and therefore oxygen to that section of the heart, and we can then minimize a lot of damage. That's a recombinant DNA product that is actually a streptokinase, even though originally the enzyme was found with staphylococcus. So staphylococcus aureus now produces an enzyme, streptokinase, that breaks down the clot, and now we can get it to go bigger. And so the abscess grows and grows and grows. While it's doing that, it can occasionally get into the bloodstream and sort of leak out. As it leaks out, it spreads throughout the body, looking for other locations where it might also cause another little colony area where we can do a wall-off abscess. One of the concerns we have with a localized staph infection that is not properly treated is that when it does spread through the bloodstream, it may get into the bone, and therefore cause osteomyelitis. So we now have another kind of problem. We've gone from a simple abscess someplace in the body that was not properly treated, and now we have an abscess forming inside the bone. Osteomyelitis. Now you recall from anatomy class, the inside of the bone is all hollowed out, honeycombed out, and the blood vascular system does not feel great there. I mean, there are obviously some fever and so on, but there's large areas where there's just bone. And as a result, it's sort of like the Taliban hanging out someplace in the stand between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Like an unruled region, the mountainous region. That's what we got inside the bone. You know, these little areas where the blood supply doesn't go and it doesn't get nailed. And so what happens then is that there's no immune response to fight it. Now we've got the organism walling itself off in an area where the immune system doesn't get too much anyway. Osteomyelitis can last for decades or more in the patient. So they can have this infection to last for many, many years. And it's very difficult to treat. Sometimes we have to surgically open up the bone, scrape out the infected areas, slap in a bolus of antibiotics and let it openly drain. So it's a very serious situation. This osteomyelitis is a complication for surgery. So anytime we have a bone surgery of some sort, orthopedic surgery, we have the potential of having this problem. Now, orthopedic surgeons are a specialized variety of surgery, sort of like carpenters. They have chisels and hammers and screws and saws and all kinds of neat equipment. You can usually tell them when they get out of the OR because they've got stuff splattered all over their shoes and things. They're not the neatest guys going, guys or girls, women or men. But the idea is that we've got a lot of rather crude kinds of things going on. And all we need to do is, in this process, have one of these instruments, because they put in screws and bolts and rods and all kinds of things into the patients. All we need to do is leave something like that in there that's contaminated with Staph aureus, and we have a problem, a major problem. The hip surgery that's contaminated results in damage to the interstitial that we just put in. And that can erode away the ball and the socket of the hip in the pelvic area, and we end up with resolving the operator. We end up with a hip that's loose now because of the erosion away because of the infection. And that's sort of a nasty place to have an infection in your hip like that. What do? Well, we generally have to take it out, and then we have to put a new fitting in, more hardware goes in, and we try to then do the best we can with what is left. So it's really not a good outcome there. So we want to avoid, at potentially all costs, sometimes those costs are significant, all costs bone infections. So they will be very much tapping into the antimicrobial supply and dosing the patient heavily when we're doing infections and doing surgeries in the body, and particularly like hip surgeries and the like, to avoid this kind of infection. Some of the consequences we'll talk about later, because there are infections elsewhere that are resulting because we have used so much antibiotics, antibiotic-associated diarrheal diseases that we'll talk about. But nonetheless, that's what we're concerned about. Where does the organism come from in surgery like that? Well, it's a little bit of a double entendre. It's a French phrase meaning double meaning, right? Double entendre. It's the hospital staff that is contributing staph aureus. What are they getting at? Well, they could have dirty hands. They could have dirty equipment, dirty meaning contaminated organisms. But you have to realize that staph aureus can colonize mucosal membranes. And so they may have, as commonly we all have, a variety of staphylococcus aureus or a staph epidermidis in our nasal passages. That's why we wear masks. Okay? We wear a mask to prevent the possible contamination from the sinus area of staph aureus into the operating field or onto an instrument or whatever. Just to avoid staph infection, staphylococcus aureus infection. It's sort of a fashion oddity, but in the 1970s or 80s or so, a fashion change occurred in the for females in the OR and ultimately throughout the hospital. Prior to that, nurses would wear skirts. But it was learned that, and actually it was Munson Medical Hospital, if I remember correctly. And it was Munson Moments, if they don't talk about it much. But at Munson Hospital, I believe it was, but certainly a hospital in Northern Michigan, they tracked down a series of nosocomial hospital-acquired infections that were staph aureus in origin to the vaginal flora of one of their nurses. So when she was in the OR, she was contaminating the OR with organisms from her vaginal flora. They checked the nasal passages, and it wasn't the organism causing the patient's problem. Checked the vaginal flora, and it was. Very unusual situation, we thought. But obviously, it turns out, maybe not so unusual, so therefore, we now have the general dress has changed to everybody wearing pants, okay, slacks, whatever you want to call it. Usually I get a question, what's the nurse wearing underwear? I don't know the answer to that question. And all that, that applies. So basically, how do we know that it wasn't one part of the body or another? How do we know it was the nurse and not the doctor and all that sort of stuff? And we have something called bacteriophage typing. Again, the relationship between this organism and viruses. Bacteriophage typing. You take the isolate from the patient, and we create a lawn, a bacterial lawn of that. And we're going to take a swab, and go back and forth in three different directions around the edges and so on. You have a thin coat of the organism. So you take the isolate from the patient, you take the isolate from the doctors and the nurses and everybody else. Again, usually it's nasal passages. And then we overlay on top of that a little grid pattern. And each of the little squares of that grid, we had a drop of a different bacteriophage. So in the first grid, we had bacteriophage number one, and then number two, and so on. And if the bacteriophage has receptor sites that match the surface of the staph aureus in that isolate, then it will cause a lytic infection. And that little area of the bacterial lawn will be clear. Okay, nothing will grow in that. So there will be a little spot. If in number two area, then it did not have a match, and therefore it did not cause a lytic infection, then there's just the growth of the bacteria. And you do this for the entire variety of bacteriophages. And you end up with a phage type, which is a listing of all of the viruses that match the receptor site of the organism that you isolated from the patient, or the doctor, or the nurse. So the doctor may have a 5 type of 1-7-17-24, meaning that 1-7-17-24 viruses in that assay match receptor sites in the surface of the cell. Remember, the receptor sites are produced by the genetic information of the bacteria. So the bacteria is creating its surface structure, its cell wall. And as it does so, it has different kinds of compounds there. And in the case of gram-positive, these are usually lipotechoic acids that are interactive. And so we have this techoic acid. Remember, it's a patchy layer of a vine growing through the wall. And it takes bits and pieces. So all it needs to do is have receptor site matching that's coded by the genetic information inside the cell. So the bacteriophage type for the doctor was one, and the patient was another, and the nurses are another, and so on. But they can match it up in some place along the line and find that the patient got it from X. Somehow X contaminated. That's where it came from. So now we have to deal with that doctor and nurse, and usually the first thing we do is instruct them on such things as hygiene, washing their hands, wearing the mask properly. Male and they have a beard, there's a certain way of having a mask around the beard, hair needs to be covered, etc. Okay. Proper number of showers taken in a daily time. If you shower too much, you can have a lot more sloughing off of your skin as it's dry and so on. So you contaminate your skin with the organism from the mucosal membrane, the skin then sloughs off like dandruff kind of thing, and as a result, that's a problem. So we have to look at these details. We can also put that person, that hospital staff person, on antimicrobial agents to get rid of the organism. That always is not necessarily successful, because what happens is for that particular bacteria isolate to grow as a normal flora, we have to have receptor site matching with the common pili and other receptor site adhesions and so on the surface of that organism matching you. Okay. So we get rid of the organism and it comes right back. Because you're exposed to somebody else's organism that has receptor site matching, and now you've got their organism, but it's the same problem. Sometimes we have tried something called bacterial interference, where we get rid of the organism with antibiotics. That's not the hard part. It's the regrowth, which is the problem. We get rid of the organism with antibiotics, and we deliberately seed them. We spray up their nose a coagulase-negative organism and attempt to get it to grow and then fill up the area so that we can't have a pathogen potentially growing in your sinuses. Again, receptor site matching, which is not well characterized or classified, is a major factor. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. In extreme settings, the person is reassigned. The nurse is taken out of the OR and they work someplace else in the hospital. The person has to be the anesthesiologist or the surgeon, and then they may have lose hospital privileges. They can't do surgery in XYZ hospital. And sometimes they take that nicely and they say, okay, I will be a dermatologist. I will do something else other than consulting. But sometimes they just are not happy about that and they get grumpy and they go to another hospital and they'll tell them that they've lost privileges at the first hospital. And lo and behold, in a better time, we have problems pop up again. And eventually it's tracked back to them. Then they move to Montana or something, and each state has their own licensing conditions and they don't communicate very well. So like driver's license, except worse. And so oftentimes we don't know why you move to Montana, but then what you say you like to hunt elk or something. Okay? So it's a problem, and it can be a difficult career-changing problem in extreme settings for some surgeons. Now, anytime we have a nosocomial infection, that's a legal definition, meaning that the patient knows about it, the patient can sue for having acquired that particular agent. Now, that requires some degree of inside information. How would you know? But it can be acquired, and there are physicians who are lawyers. Imagine that, physicians who are lawyers, and they know exactly what to do and where to look and who to ask and all that kind of stuff. So it's a whole legal business to sue physicians. And they, of course, have their own insurance, which is malpractice insurance, and et cetera, et cetera. And hospitals have their own insurance. So hospitals are the ones that are paying the bills, don't get found in practice sometimes, if they're involved. Because the hospital becomes involved because they knew the guy or woman or whoever was problem because they did the testing, they did the body typing, they knew the person was a problem, and they let them continue to work, that's when their liability kicks in. And so it gets a little messy. That's Staph aureus in terms of nosocomial infections, a major problem we've been working with in hospitals, and not an easy solution. Well, the organism can cause other kinds of problems, and it picks up additional virulence factors. So all what we talked about so far is your base organism. To that base organism, we can add other factors usually brought in by bacterial viruses, and these other factors are, again, in addition to what we just talked about. So an organism that can cause this problem can also cause other problems. It could be something called staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome. SSSS. Staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome. In this particular case, the organism produces an exfoliating toxin. Exfoliating meaning the skin is coming off. Some people in their personal hygiene and their beautification and so on want to get rid of the dead skin, and they have sort of harsh, physically like sandpaper, or harsh soaps that they rub on to exfoliate. Okay, so this is an exfoliating toxin. And the exfoliating toxin is associated with newborns, neonates, usually under the age of about 4 weeks or so. They still have the umbilical cord on when they come from the hospital, right? And the parents are given a little booklet on how the care and feeding of their child, no, they're not really, but they're given instructions as they leave about the umbilical cord. And they are to put alcohol or something like that onto the umbilical cord to, quote, dry it out. Well, they're not really drying it out so much, although that does the nature of the protein. What we're trying to do is basically in a natural, normal situation, the umbilical cord will fall off. It's not well vasculated, of course, and it will just simply fall off. Sort of mummified kind of thing. It falls off with like a little button by the time it falls off. Not a big deal. Okay? However, that dead and dying tissue can be a nutrient source for organisms, including Staphylococcus aureus. If the umbilical stump gets infected, this is part of the other instructions, if it becomes red and looks nasty, be sure to talk to the doctor. Because this organism, when it has the exfoliating toxin, will invade the umbilical stump and produce a toxin that will spread across the belly and down the groin into the legs. This exfoliation means that we're losing the ability to keep fluid in the body. This young child, only a few weeks old, is now becoming severely dehydrated to the point of dying. When first seen in the emergency room, this exfoliation with loss of surface skin, revealing the tissue underneath, which is very red now, it looks as if someone took hot coffee and poured it on the kid's belly and groin. It looks like child abuse. In fact, typically in the emergency room setting, a differentiation between infection and child abuse is generally begun. Until we actually isolate the organism, it's still a possibility. It's one of those things we put up on Hausl's chalkboard, differential diagnosis. What could it be? Could be child abuse when you first look at it. And until you get the lab test results confirming that we have Staph aureus with the exfoliating toxin that explains the answer, then we know that it wasn't hot coffee. Until then, we don't know what did that. It looks like a burn. Staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome. SSSS. It's about 70% fatal if not treated early. And usually fatality is associated with severe dehydration. So if we get it when the umbilical stump is red, we can deal with that easily enough. But if it's the whole lower portion of the body, it can be a fatal event. So parents are advised to keep an eye on the umbilical stump. And if it turns red or the area around it becomes red, seek medical attention. Toxic shock syndrome, TSS. TSS, toxic shock syndrome. This is an interesting medical anomaly we took a while to figure out. It was associated with women using highly absorbent tampons, long-lasting tampons. And as a result, we thought initially that the organism was somehow growing on the tampon and using the tampon material as a nutrient source or something. And so the first inclination of what to do was to avoid and stop production of these long-lasting, highly absorbent tampons. However, further research was required to find out really what was going on. That was a possible thing, so we needed to take care of that as a possible problem. But what was really going on? It's really an interesting phenomenon. What happens is that the organism that produces the toxin, most likely on a non-self-replicating plasmid brought into the organism by a virus, not completely nailed down, but we think that's what it is. The toxin is not being produced because a repressor protein in the operon where the toxin gene is made. So under normal circumstances, the toxin is not made, a repressor protein is made, and it turns out that the repressor protein requires divalent cations such as magnesium and calcium to complete a functional repressor protein. The highly absorbent tampon removed all varieties of things, including divalent cations, making the vaginal flora area deplete of divalent cations. Therefore, the organism growing in that environment could not produce the repressor protein, ergo, the toxin was produced. Strange relationship between operon level control and virulence and a potentially fatal disease. Toxic shock syndrome is involved with a multi-organ system failure in the patient. A very severe problem when we have it. So, toxic shock syndrome, usually we don't see it commonly now because of those highly absorbent tampons. The tampons are not around and they are not absorbing the divalent cations and so on. But there's still been cases. There was one just about 3 years ago, a college-aged student, female. I don't think she went to Paris, but she was from a surrounding college, college university in the Grand Rapids area, was getting prepared for her wedding. She was driving on 28th Street in Grand Rapids. She's probably all been there, shopping malls and the like, lots of cars that this day. Okay. She was involved in a severe accident, a closed head injury, and she was put in a nursing home. And while she was in a nursing home here, in this side of the state, she was moved back to the other side of the state, which I think is where she was, home was, still in a coma. And over in the Bay City area, I believe it was, she was diagnosed with toxic shock syndrome. Now, she had been in medical care at that point for 3 or 4 weeks, and nobody ever checked to see if she had a tampon. Imagine that. And so she had a case of toxic shock syndrome. Tampon was just left in for that long. Normally that would not be the case, but stuff happens. Mistakes are made. So basically, we still see it on occasion, but it's not a common problem. And again, the key in understanding why it's a problem sometimes and other times is the operon level control. The repressor protein requires divalent cations. If they are present, if they normally would be, then it's not a problem. If they're removed for some reason, then it becomes a problem. Staphylococcal enterocolitis. Staphylococcal enterocolitis is another clinical entity we need to look at. Staphylococcal enterocolitis. This is associated with usually a bile resectioning of some surgical procedure in the intestinal tract. Maybe the person had gunshot knife wounds, where we have 47 different perforations of the gut. Sometimes we can patch them up, sometimes we can't. So if we can't, we can simply remove that section of the intestinal tract and just make it shorter. It could be strangulation of the intestinal tract as a result of a tumor or something. But we have to remove the tumor and also the area of the intestinal tract which has become necrotic. At any rate, we have this surgery done in the gut. Obviously, well, there's lots of organisms in intestinal tract. And if they get out of the intestinal tract, they can invade the peritoneal cavity, resulting in peritonitis. Surgeons would like to avoid that kind of problem, just like the orthopedic surgeon. The surgeon doing the GI tract surgery wants to get rid of all the possible problems, and those problems are normal flora organisms in the intestinal tract. And so heavy doses of antimicrobial agents could be, not recommended for the following reason, but could be and have done in the past when given them to these patients. In fact, the surgeons smiling, a little sort of stupid smile, but they smile and say, it's bile sterilization. They have no respect for the little critters in the gut. Okay. So we'll exterminate them all, bile sterilization. Well, what happens is that if the surgeon involved or their staff in some way adds Staphylococcus aureus mechanism, we talked about nasal passages and so on, and into that gut. Now, there's no gram-negative organisms. There are no anaerobic organisms that are gram-positive. There are no organisms there. And now we've introduced this foreign-born critter that has no competition. They stitch up the gut. Everything looks fine. Within 24 hours, the patient's back in surgery again. In this case, the organism has eroded away large areas of the intestinal tract, and the area of initial damage was probably small compared to what they have now. So they have to greatly shorten the intestinal tract, possibly put in a colostomy bag, and it gets pretty messy. So, staphylococcal enterocolitis is a problem. The solution to the problem is to not completely destroy all the organisms in the intestinal tract. Reduce some numbers, okay, but don't get rid of them all. Allow some to be there to compete with a possible contamination that should not occur from the hospital staff. By allowing some organisms to survive to protect the gut from the staph aureus that may be introduced, that's part of the solution. The other part, of course, is if you've seen people from surgery, we have a lot of tubes coming out of our peritoneal area, and we're looking for, is it running clear? Did we get any fluid at all? Is it pussy? Does it smell? Obviously, if there's pus there, if the fluid coming out is not clear, meaning we have cells in there, that's not a good sign. Okay? But we leave that tube in postoperatively to see what's going on in the gut, to see if we have a problem. If we wait until the patient complains of abdominal pain, that may be too late. Remember, they just had a section of their intestine taken out as it is. They've had their gut opened up. It's going to hurt. So when do you draw the line between that's normal recovery pain and this is a different kind of pain and it requires us to take a look and do reopening another surgery? It's hard to determine. One patient's pain is not the next person's pain. Pain is very relative from person to person. So it's hard to determine. The tube allows us to do that. That's why we have a drainage tube. How about the strep pyogenes? Strep pyogenes, so we talked about how strep throat, we already mentioned that one, right? It can cause wound infections as well. It's also associated with a skin lesion we may have mentioned, but we can bring it up again now, and that's infantago in children. Infantago is largely caused by strep pyogenes. Which is a gram-positive cockle-shaped organism in chains. Strep is in the chains. This organism is the lead organism in contagio, but this is going to cause a lot of irritation, itchiness in the skin, and the child will scratch it, and the child with contagio will then add staph aureus. So if you see it clinically, it's usually a mixed infection. A mixed infection of strep pyogenes, the lead organism, and staph aureus, a common secondary organism that causes the original problem. Anytime we have scratching of the skin and irritation, we can add staph aureus to that, and that will complicate the matter. Chicken pox gets itchy, okay? Probably varicella virus, and it's another childhood kind of problem. The blisters on that are generally clear. If you see it clinically, then maybe a whole bunch of them are all red. What's happening? The child has scratched it, and they've added staph aureus. So even though it's caused by a viral problem, we sometimes use topical antibiotics to prevent the possible scarring. Chicken pox, the pox mark is a mark on your skin where you had a lesion. That lesion mark is left behind not because of the viral infection, but rather because of the Staph aureus that was added to it. So oftentimes we have Staph aureus added to things. So we always have to think about it being there. Even if it's a viral lesion on the skin, if you scratch it, you're going to add Staph aureus. Okay, so we have infantago being a problem. One of the other problems we see with strep pyogenes is it's got an interesting history and a great degree of misnomer. Flesh-eating virus comes to mind as one thing that it's called. We call this necrotizing vasculitis. Necrotizing vasculitis. The newspapers at the checkout call it the flesh-eating virus. Obviously, it's not a virus, right? It's strep pyogenes. Fascia is that thin tissue paper film like material that covers bone, covers muscle and ligaments and so on. If you have a fresh sample, an autopsy, it's a lot easier to see. But you can still see it in the preserved specimens that we use, the autopsy patients, former patients, that we use in the ferret. I don't know if you went to ferret. How many people, and you all had human body and made it to them? But it can be, so the human body part, you're doing that, you can see this thin, sort of filmy, kind of gummy kind of material. It's not gummy and natural, but it is on an autopsy after the preserved specimens and so on. And basically, what that is, that's fascia, which is basically collagen. And so the organism produces a collagen ACE, and it invades into the skin through some sort of puncture or some sort of lesion initially, gets down to the level of the fascia, and then spreads laterally at that tissue layer. So it's like mining out coal. It just spreads right through that fascia. It's got a collagen ACE, and then it breaks down collagen. Now, when you look at from the outside at this lesion, it may be only a centimeter across. But a little bit down into the skin, where the fascia layer is, it may be 6 centimeters across. So the area of actual damage is a lot greater than what it appears. And as it destroys the fascia layer, it destroys the capillary bed that supports the blood supply to the tissue above it. So this little size of a dime area with an area that's several inches larger below that in the fascia layer begins spreading. As you destroy the tissue underneath the blood supply, it spreads. Once it gets going, it can spread in the diameter of an inch an hour. An inch an hour sounds fast, but when you put it into 24 hours, you can see you've got a major problem. The necrotizing vasculitis can be a fatal problem. It's not an unusual problem. That is, it's not like never heard of, it's seen only in textbooks. We have hundreds of cases a year in the United States. Several cases a year in Michigan. And so what happens is that we need to treat that aggressively with surgery first. We have to remove the organism. We don't have time to put the patient on a 10-day course of antibiotics. It's going at an inch an hour, 10 days, a lot of hours. You can't make it. And so we have to surgically remove, and that's always scary to the patient, because what looks like it's a small area, when they go into surgery, when they come out, a large mass of tissue has been removed. It looks like a bullet wound or something. But basically what's happening is that maybe a third of your calf is gone. You had a small hole in your leg. Now you have a third of your calf gone. Or maybe a third or a half of your thigh is gone. And you had only a small little cut. And this is major. And they have to do it that way because if it gets out of control, you die. So a lot depends on where that infection is, just what the outcome will be. If the infection is in the abdominal cavity and over a woman that had on the vaginal wall, cervical wall. The cervix, he had the infection and they couldn't do anything about it. It went up in his abdomen cavity before they do it. So it can be serious. It must be taken seriously in terms of aggressive treatment and surgical procedure. I know another fellow that lost about a third of his thigh, and the problem was on Friday evening when he was working at his carpentry stuff in his basement, that he bumped his thigh on a table and got a little cut. But the bump was enough to really cause like a little hemorrhage in that area and so on. And by Saturday afternoon, you know, he already had problems. And by Monday, they took out a large section of the stock. It was that quick. So it needs to be quickly addressed because the organism, once it finds the right layer in the tissue, nothing's going to stop it. Okay, so necrotizing fasciitis, a collagenase produced by the organism. It's not a flesh-eating virus. Escherichia coli, Klebsiella pneumoniae, both of these organisms can be found in the intestinal tract and can be then associated with breaks in the integrity of the intestinal tract, resulting in infections in the peritoneal cavity. So we can get E. coli, for example, causing peritonitis. Actually, any of the organisms found in the intestinal tract. And there are lots of them. Probably in the order of 1,000 different species of organisms in the intestinal tract. So by talking about E. coli, it's not by any means talking about the common ones or the most common ones or whatever. There's lots of them. And they're almost always going to be mixed infections that you would expect. So organisms in the intestinal tract, such as E. coli, Klebsiella, and we'll mention a variety of anaerobes, strict anaerobes, they can cause peritonitis. This can lead to maybe someone has a ruptured appendix, for example. And so now we have the contents of the intestinal tract spilled out. When they're spilled out in the abdominal cavity, remember the anatomy is such that for females, this can lead to infections in the ovary and so on. And so when we have a peritonitis, it's a serious kind of problem. We need to go in and lavage, to rinse out the entire cavity to make sure we don't have any pockets that we haven't cleaned out. And we need to look for possible abdominal infections later, whether we have the tube. We may have to go back in and maybe remove an ovary or something from a young girl who had peritonitis. All these are possible because the organisms are spread throughout the peritoneal cavity. Inside the gut, there's not a problem. Outside the gut, there become a problem. Pseudomonas organism. Pseudomonas is another gram-negative organism, but the last three are gram-negative. They're all gram-negative as well. Pseudomonas organism is found in soil. It has many, many exoenzymes. As we alluded to before, I believe, some of these exoenzymes can be used commercially to dissolve oil slicks. In terms of infections, they are a serious consideration. We can have a Pseudomonas eye infection, for example. Sometimes patients have an irritation in their eye, they have contact lenses, so they get a red eye reaction. This could be an allergic reaction, it could be infection. It could be infection with bacteria, fungal, or virus. So there's many possibilities that have to be taken into consideration on our house chalkboard for the possible things. But the Pseudomonas is involved. Sometimes the patient also notes that the prescription is changing or that they feel that they need new contacts. What's happening is the organism is actually digesting the soft contact, changing the prescription, changing the index of refraction. It can enucleate the eye. So it's a serious infection that has to be addressed rather heavily with antibiotics and so on. The organism can also cause serious burn wound infections. At one point in the 80s, we were losing far more patients because we improved our emergency procedures of dealing with burn patients we were losing many, many patients with infection after they were in the hospital. It was clearly a nosocomial infection. They would be in the hospital in the burn unit for 3 weeks, 6 weeks, or longer, only then to die of Pseudomonas infection. It was a pretty severe problem. And so we thought of developing a vaccine for Pseudomonas. And so we did. And it was called Pseudogen, as in antigen, Pseudogen. And Pseudogen worked quite well in all the controls we did it. We injected this in a perfectly healthy person, and they produced antibodies that are protective. However, when we injected it in the patients we were looking for, the burn patients, when they come into the hospital and part of their early medical treatment would be to give them Pseudogen, it didn't work at all. They weren't producing antibodies. So there was something different about the immune system of these patients that had to be explored. Well, we found out that when a burn patient, whether it's a chemical burn or a thermal burn, a burn patient, their body goes into shock, a metabolic shock, one we weren't aware of. They go into a nitrogen imbalance. They stop making proteins. Began cannibalizing their own proteins. That's why they weren't making any response. They weren't making antibodies or protein, because they weren't making any proteins. The problem was much bigger than simply not responding to a vaccine. So we had to somehow address that. I don't know who, but somebody came across the approach of hyperalimentation, much like when we have a coma patient, we force feed them in a tube, flurry of high protein. And we began doing that to these patients. We found that a sudden increase in protein in the diet, of course this is a slurry that we're giving people, we can actually reverse this nitrogen imbalance. So we can, the patient gets over their metabolic reaction, their shock reaction, and starts functioning metabolically, which now means that they're producing an immune response, which then protects them against Pseudomonas and everything else, and they start to do repair of the blood, the repair of the burn wound and so on. And they don't even need Pseudogen. And they respond quite well, thank you, we don't need the vaccine. So the vaccine was an interesting idea, but it's not necessary. First, it didn't work, and when it did work, it wasn't necessary, because once we convert patient to a normal nitrogen situation, normal protein synthesis, then they can protect themselves. So hyperalimentation, force feeding high protein nutrient source to the patients, reverses the nitrogen imbalance, reduces the infection rate, increases the survival rate significantly. It doesn't take much Pseudomonas to cause a problem, though, in a burn patient. The introduction of the organism, since it's coming out of soil, comes from anything that comes from the soil. Flowers in the patient room. We've isolated Pseudomonas from the salad and cafeteria of the hospital. It's on the shoes of people who walk into the hospital. It's in the carpeting, in the floors. It's everywhere. Okay. It can be difficult to treat. It's got lots of antimicrobial resistances, lots of R factors. Occasionally, we isolate a patient from a patient of Pseudomonas variety that is untreatable with any known antibiotic. That's rare, but it's early in the game. Maybe it won't be so rare in the year 2015 or 2030. So this is sort of the king of the beasties. It's got lots of exoenzymes. It can digest all manners of things, not just simply people things, but digest, as I mentioned, blood pressure breathing apparatus things, you know, the gaskets there. It can survive the use of detergents in the mop for housekeeping if they don't mix it up properly and then spray it through the mop. It's amazing where it can get in the hospital. Never underestimate where Pseudomonas can get in the patient. Pseudomonas, nasty bug. Anaerobe. These are strict anaerobes. These are organisms that are killed by the presence of oxygen. Remember, they will try to use oxygen, but they don't have catalases and phosphatases and so on. have superoxide dismutase. So they'll be killed by oxygen. They are generally not difficult to treat. All the ones that we see here are gram positives. Some are rods and some are cockle shaped, but they are all gram positives. And to date, although it is beginning to change, to date they've not been a difficult group to treat. But remember, they are part of this thousand different species, most of which are not pathogens, that are in your intestinal tract. And as we take antibiotics from early earaches that we didn't need it because it wasn't an infection yet, to sore throats that were viral, and so on and so on. So by the time you are in your 20s, you've had numerous uses of antibiotics, some of which are questionable in use. And as we use them, we select for resistance inside the patient. The less we use it, the less resistance we select. So the resistance we're selecting for is in these thousands of different organisms that are in the intestinal tract. Clostridium perfringens is the lead organism causing a phenomenon of gas gangrene. But the next five organisms, let's see, next four organisms are all associated with gangrene as well. So that means the Clostridium perfringens is the lead organism, Bacteroides fragilis and Bacteroides melanogenicus will hang on there and they'll be present. Streptococcus anaerobus, Streptococcus anaerobus, Streptococcus magnus. These four, in addition to Clostridium, are examples of the kinds of organisms that we'll find. The Bacteroides organisms are rod-shaped organisms, as is Clostridium. Peptostreptococcus and Streptococcus are both cockle-shaped organisms. And again, all of those five are gram-positive. Just for the record, this slide I've used now for quite a number of years, and talking with some of the PharmDs, they say, gee, the students say they never heard of Bacteroides. So I've said it three times, Bacteroides. But you will hear it again. So we have Bacteroides fragilis, Bacteroides melanogenicus, Peptostreptococcus anaerobus, and Peptostreptococcus magnus are agents that are strict anaerobes that join in with Clostridium perfringens, causing what we call gas gangrene. Now, this begins with a simple wound infection. And by that we mean we have a little bit of redness at the margin or edge of the wound. Sort of like a paper cut. Okay? You have a paper cut and you have a little redness at the edge of the wound. This then is the simple wound infection can develop into myonecrosis. Myo referring to muscle, necrosis meaning death. Myonecrosis, or death of muscle tissue. This will result in blackness in the area around the wound. And now we're extending away from the margin of the wound, but we're really going several centimeters around. We still don't have gangrene. We're just in the second stage, myonecrosis. Muscle death. The third stage is the actual gangrene. Now at this stage we have the organism beginning to spread throughout the bloodstream, but more importantly, its exotoxins precede. So now we're loading up the body with exoenzymes that are affecting a variety of tissues throughout the body. So we end up with a multi-organ system failure, just like we saw in the case of toxic shock syndrome. The spread of the toxins around the body are causing many areas to be affected that are distal or away from the actual infection site. In extreme settings, we can go from simple wound infection to myonecrosis to gas gangrene and potential death in 72 hours. But typically, it's not that quick. Particularly if we have medical intervention, person in the hospital, it can be spread out for weeks before we get to the stage of gas gangrene. The critical component is to have anaerobic conditions in the tissue. Without that, these organisms do not grow. Without that, these organisms can grow. So we have to get the organisms into the womb, and we have to get anaerobic conditions. If we took the organism in a sterile syringe, and injected it into your body, it's got a good amount of oxygen tension concentration, we injected that into you, nothing would happen. The oxygen concentration in normal tissue will kill these organisms. So we have to have anaerobic conditions to get that. How do we get those anaerobic conditions? That's an important factor to consider. So in order to get gas gangrene, we have to have it. By the way, the phrase gas, in the myelonecrosis stage, the skin can become brittle and translucent, sort of like fried chicken. When you're cooking fried chicken, the skin gets sort of clear and brittle, crispy chicken. But we got crispy skin, okay? And it becomes more brittle and less plastic. And it's not exactly like chicken, but it's like that skin. And it will then hold in the gases out, which is more brittle, and the gases coming out will result in the bubbling or the gas gangrene. In any of these anaerobes, the end products of their fermentations and anaerobic respirations are such that it is really pungent. The aromatic compounds produced will produce smells that you've never heard or never smelled before. I've heard about it. You've never smelled it before. They sort of get up in your sinuses and you can't get it out. Ultimately, you can smell these patients down the hall before you can get on the floor. A double set of doors are down there. You haven't even gotten to the floor yet. You can smell that patient. Now, the patient has become aware of the smell, and they will sometimes complicate matters by trying to cover up the smell. I know a fellow that had a gangrene foot problem, and he put his foot in a plastic bag and put several rubber bands around the edges to hold it in place, obviously cutting down circulation even more. So we have the Clostridium perfringens then. How do we get the anaerobic conditions? Well, the classic situation is that of a diabetic. Diabetic has a problem in sugar and carbohydrates. You're familiar with that, with insulin and all that. We got that now about chemistry. However, the patient's got a lot more problems than that. One of the problems they have is repair of blood vascular system. Because they can't adequately repair the blood vascular system because of glucose sticking to the inside of the blood vessels, glycosylation occurring, areas distal from the heart are usually affected first. And so we have loss of blood supply to the feet and hands. We also can have impotence in the male. We can also see problems in the eyes, all related to improper blood supply. So if we don't get blood supply to our feet, we have anaerobic conditions in our feet. This is a progressive disease, and it will gradually go up the foot, up the leg, and so on, as we begin losing more and more oxygen. Part of that will be loss of peripheral nerve function or peripheral neuropathy. And so we had that in physiology. We can do a two-point assay, right? You know what that means? You know what I mean by two-point? You take two probes and you put them in the field and all that. And so we can do that in the person's feet, upper leg, and so on, to find out just what kind of sensations they have. That gives you an idea of the degree of peripheral neuropathy. There's also skin changes. We have drying of the skin and actual change in pigmentation and so on can all occur. All of that is a result of the anaerobic conditions. The skin becomes very dry, becomes a little alligator-like in some respects. So all of this is secondary to the fact that we're not getting blood supply. All of that are telltale signs that we have anaerobic conditions in the tissue. And once we have anaerobic conditions in the tissue, we can have an anaerobic infection. So we need to... The patient needs to be aware of what these signs are and what they mean, because if a diabetic patient is a chronically ill patient, it will not get better. We can then slow it down to how bad it gets worse. You can have diabetics that become 90 years old because they're very good at doing what they have to do. And they've got their arms and legs and their feet and walking around and they don't have problems. They deal with their issues. We also have diabetics in their early 30s that are already having arms and legs lopped off because of infections and so on. So it's, part of it is the progression of the disease, but that progression of the disease in part is their response to having the disease. Anytime you have a chronic disease, you have the possibility of a person being depressed about it. And depression certainly means that they're not going to pay attention to it, they're going to fight it, they're going to resist it, they're going to ignore it. All of these things lead to the anaerobic infection. And it doesn't take a major thing. Once we have the anaerobic conditions, the opposite of what we said before, we take the organism and inject it in, nothing happens. Once we have the anaerobic conditions, we get the organism in, we have a problem. And we progress rather quickly. So it could be nothing more complicated than wearing those orange shoes for the wedding because they matched the outfit. They didn't fit quite right and you get a blister. Or you're playing basketball and you should wear two pairs of socks, but you only wear one pair of socks and you get a blister. That's all it takes. An ingrown toenail, improper cutting of your toenail. How boring can cutting your toenail be? If not doing it properly leads to ingrown toenail, leads to an infection, leads to the loss of the foot, etc. So they always have to be, they're on the edge. They have to be very, very careful. And you have to support them in the effort of being careful. So these organisms are just out there. Now, you can also have anaerobic conditions that secondary to some sort of crush wound, an accident of backpacking or a car accident or something. We have a crush wound. And the area distal from the crush wound can be anaerobic. Those are a little easier to deal with in the sense that we have an otherwise healthy individual. Once we surgically repair that part of the body, even if it goes to the point of amputation, that person is ahead of the game as compared to the diabetic. Because that means the stump for that otherwise healthy person is going to heal over quite well. So we have soldiers wounded in action, losing body parts, arms, legs, getting prosthesis put on in their leg or something like that. That's a good outcome, considering all the possible things that could have been. The diabetic, not so much, because that stump is not getting good blood supply, even though we did great effort to get good blood supply in that stump, where we cut it off above the knee, above the ankle, below the ankle, above the knee, and so on. As we try to cut that off of getting good blood supply, even rerouting some blood vascular system, the time we did the surgery is fine. 2 years later, however, the disease progressed some more. So that stump is not a good stump that we can put a prosthesis on. So they're a different kind of patient. Once a patient loses their foot, loses their leg, they become less ambulatory, they're not walking around, obviously, as well. They may be in a wheelchair. You remember in terms of circulatory dynamics, when you're walking around, that walking is moving your leg, squeezing the calf, puts blood back into your heart and so on. Without that, we end up with pulmonary congestion, and we lead to cardiac problems, etc. All of that because we're not walking around. So major effort has to be up front with the diabetics to keep their feet. If you keep them from losing body parts, they can live quite a long time. If they start losing body parts because of the problem, then we have increasingly other problems developing. And diabetes is something that is an explosive situation in the United States. You will see a significant number of patients in which diabetes is part of their problem. And of course, they can get car accidents and they can have other kinds of infections and everything else, and they're at risk for all kinds of additional complications. All right, Clostridia tetanus. Obviously, this is a gram-positive organism. All the Clostridia organisms are gram-positive rods. They all produce spores. So all the Clostridia organisms produce spores. So Clostridium and tetany and Difficile all produce spores. In this case, the spores get into the wound, germinate, the vegetative cell produces the toxin, called tetanospasm, causing a contraction. Botulism, Clostridium botulatum, also rod-shaped organism. Gram-positive produces spores. But that produces a flaccid or relaxed
This one produces a contraction, spasm.
But you tend to need them. Spasm, toxin, exotoxin, causes the problem of tetanus. Again, it doesn't have to be a major insult into the body. We usually have about 1,000 cases a year in the United States that are trivial injuries, that is, literally paper cut kinds of problems, nothing major, but if you get the spore in there. And if the person is not protected by having the proper antitoxin, then they've got a potential problem. In the United States, we are very, very, very aggressive with the use of tetanus toxoid. Okay. So if you go into the emergency room for almost anything, you will be given a tetanus shot. And it doesn't matter whether you said you got one last week, that's fine, we'll give you another one this week. They'll ask you when your last tetanus shot is, and that's just part of the conversation, because regardless of what you say, you will also get another one. Okay? So we're very, very aggressive. And it's for good reason, because once the patient actually gets intoxicated with the toxin, it's a very difficult disease condition to deal with. Now, we will treat that patient with the use of antitoxin. There's only a few serotypes, so that's not a problem. What the problem is the same problem we mentioned before when we talked about the use of antitoxin, that is, the patient will get a little bit worse before it stabilizes, because the toxin has no effect, the antitoxin has no effect on bound toxin. And so while you're trying to neutralize all the free toxin in the bloodstream, you will have additional toxin binding. And after a few hours, it will stabilize, and it will stay like that for several weeks. It's gotten to the point now that in some cases, we put them into a medically induced coma so that they avoid stimulation, sounds, lights going on, whatever. And because that will create the spasm situation. So basically, we put them in a coma in the extreme settings. Other settings, we can simply neutralize the toxin and deal with the minor amounts of spasms that they have. But if it's severe, we put them into a coma to keep them away from the shocks and stimulations. And usually, depending on how much toxin is found, in a matter of days or weeks, we can have the person back online again. There is something that I refer to as an emergency room conflict. Emergency room conflict talks about efficacia. Efficacia is the effectiveness of a treatment. Okay. One is it can work in a lab, it can work on a textbook, but what do you actually do clinically? And it may not be the same thing in pump. In the case of this setting, it's counterintuitive. What we do doesn't make sense in some respects. If we have a patient that has not been given tetanus toxoid before, and they have a wound that has been around for several days and not treated properly, then we're going to want to give you a tetanus booster. If you've had it before, that'll be fine. But if you've never had a tetanus shot, which is not the typical person, because we're so aggressive, it's part of the DPTs, childhood immunizations, and so on. But we're very aggressive, but we do have people come into the emergency room that are not from the United States. For example, in Michigan, we see immigrant workers from Mexico, Guatemala, and so on. Farm workers who get injured on the job are concerned about being reported to INS and deported. And so they're not going to go to seek medical attention because that might be something official and might not want to be sent back to their home country. And they treat with whatever they can. And there's a variety of different kinds of poultices and so on. People put herbs and spices and they put it up against that. Bacon, they'll put bacon onto that. I'm actually not interested in bacon, of course, it's high salt. And high salt will actually kill some organisms. It's not necessarily going to kill all organisms, but it will kill some. So there's some reason to some of these things, in fact. Kerosene, another common one, not so good. I mean, it just smells bad. So they'll put kerosene on the wound. It won't light it or anything like that. They'll just put kerosene on. So they come to the emergency room where they an infection that's been going on for a couple of weeks in their hand or something like that. We'd like to give them the toxoid, but since they've never had it before, and it's going to take 7-10 days or longer for them to produce the antibody, that's not going to be sufficient. So we're going to give them antibody at the same time as we clean up the wound and give antibiotics. We're going to give them antitoxin. When we inject the antitoxin around the margin of the lumen, that's where the toxin is present. That's where we first, right? So we clean up the wound, we have antibiotics, and we inject in the area around the wound, in the tissue around the wound, we inject the antibody to the toxin. Now, under normal circumstances, you might expect, and it would be reasonable to expect, that we'll tell them to come back in 2 weeks, we'll look at the wound, change the bandage or whatever, and then we're going to give you the tetanus toxoid. But the reason why the patient wasn't there in the first place, the same reason why they're not going to come back in 2 weeks when they feel better. So we have to do something which doesn't make a lot of sense. But it works. We will do, as I said, we'll clean up the wound by the antibiotics and we'll put it in the margin of the wound, the antitoxin. And then distal to that, so the other part of the body, we're going to inject you with the toxoid. Now, toxoid is the antigen, and the antibody we injected is the antibody. They will neutralize one another in the patient of the body, in the body of the patient. So we're sort of minimizing the effectiveness of each. But the residual effect will be, if there was a toxin, we removed the organism and we added the antitoxin and we've added antibiotics. Chances are the spreading of a little nil. So then we will then have the antitoxin, which will then stimulate some protection in this patient in the future. It's not the ideal situation. You'll lose some effectiveness of using the antitoxin and the toxic toxoid in the patient at the same time. But that's the emergency room conflict. What do we do that's best for the patient? Not out of the textbook, but what's practical. Okay, so that's Clostridia tetani. Clostridia difficile. Clostridia difficile associated diarrhea. CDAD. Clostridia difficile associated diarrhea. In this setting, we have typically an elderly patient that has had hip surgery, a plastic patient. A lot of variations of that, but that's a plastic patient. Because they had hip surgery, the orthopedic surgeon was concerned about staph aureus and other kinds of problems, so they heavily medicate in terms of lots of antibiotics, pre-op as well as post-op. So for 2 weeks or so after surgery, they're taking lots of antibiotics. Now they're out of the hospital in about 5 days, and they're in a rehab center, learning how to walk again with a new hip and so on, exercising, eventually getting through the walker, going from the walker to the cane, and so on and so on. And while this is happening, the antimicrobial effect is showing itself. We have, remember, 1,000 different species of organisms. If we put it into numbers, total numbers, you have about 10 trillion cells in your body. 10 trillion cells that make up the human body. There are about 100 trillion organisms in your gut. 100 trillion. 10 to 1 more of them than you. You have them from about day 3 to 5. You start getting them. And these organisms in your intestinal tract, as they're a child, come in the same sort of succession that we see, remember in general biology where we have a pond, maybe we have a stream and then the beavers dam it up and we get a pond, and then we have certain kinds of trees that grow on the edge of the pond, and eventually the pond fills in and becomes a meadow, and we have bushes and softwoods, pines and so on start growing in. And then over the years, we start getting more and more hardwoods and oaks and things. Remember all that? Exact same thing is occurring in the gut, beginning at about age 3 to 5 days of age. Okay. Breastfeeding helps because the mother provides some organisms. But regardless of how they get there, one set of organisms sets up another set of organisms, sets up another set of organisms. So this 100 trillion organisms of 1,000 different species don't drop down on you all at once. One sets up the next, sets up the next, sets up the next. Okay. So now we have someone who's 85 years old, who just had hip surgery, but now has a gut of a 3-day-year-old child. They kill off all the bugs. Well, maybe not all the bugs. Because some of the bugs are a little more resistant. And other organisms, if they're exposed, and in this setting of the rehab center, we are exposing them. And one of the organisms that we're exposing them to is Clostridium difficile. The spores are all over the place in these rehab patients. And the organism begins to grow in the gut. There's nobody else there. It's not the normal sequence event, so it's not like it's going to be kept in some sort of balance. There's nothing to balance it off. So now we have the organism growing in great abundance. And as it does, it produces toxins. And the toxins will erode the gut, resulting in perforation of the gut and peritonitis. So now we have this 85-year-old person who's got diarrhea, loss of fluid, dehydration. Now the organism is getting into the gut and the bloodstream. So now we have fever and all manners of things. Many people who develop this problem are dead within 6 to 9 months. I think very high percentage, 70-some percent are dead within about 9 months. And you may have heard a lot about someone, older person, a foul break of hip, and then before you know it, they die. Well, this is part of that process. Because we got in because the gut has changed, because we used the antibiotics to prevent the infection and save their life. So in the process of saving them, we lost them. And the key mechanism, the key ingredient here, is the use of antibiotics. An antibiotic-associated diarrhea that threatens the life of the patient all the time. Sometimes, in these patients, we can put a colostomy bag in them. That is, we've lost so much of intestine that when we go into this patient to remove the intestinal tract, we only got a few feet left. Okay. So now we put an opening in the side, and we make a stoma, an opening, and we have then a colostomy bag, so that's where the fecal material comes out of that, and this is not the normal way of doing things. It all started when they fell and broke their hip. Or it could be osteoporosis and their hip broke and then they fell, and toss up sometimes. But this is something that no one expected, and this is the something that's going to kill them. So what can we do about this? Well, we have to realize that this organism is most likely, now once they've had it, they'll probably have it in their intestinal tract for the rest of their number of days, but they didn't necessarily have it when they came in. So it's probably, their exposure is not endogenous, but rather, well, possible. But usually it's exogenous. That means they're exposed to the spores in the rehab center. Okay. And once you notice the odor of C. diff, as it's called, you will recognize it when you go into the nursing center, in the rehab center. You can smell it on the floor. You don't know who it is, but you can smell it. And so the education of the staff, the constant vigilance against spores. Killing the spore is not an easy thing. And so it's just, you have to consider it to be everywhere, and you have to be constantly vigilant. That's one thing. The other thing we have to realize is that we've got an 85-year-old person with a gut that's 3 days old. How do we deal with that? Well, there's been some interesting, almost disgusting, but effective forms of treatment. The Canadians had a problem in Toronto, I believe it was, I don't think it was Montreal, in Toronto. It got so bad that the surgeons in the city decided not to do hip replacements on patients over a certain age, usually 80. If they were losing them, hip is in fine shape, but they died of the C. diff. In high rates, 80% or more. So what they decided to do was not to do the surgeries, that's one solution. So the people then basically lay in bed and eventually it healed one way or another, and that's the way they're going to be. Better than dying, they thought. Another solution, and that's not a preferable solution, but that's something that's been done. Another solution, which really seems out of the box, but this is an out of the box problem. How do we reestablish that gut? How is it that we have normal flora organisms? Well, our diet selects amongst these 1,000 different species and selects for winners and losers, that is, the ratio of the various varieties in the population. So that mixture of organisms that we carry around in our gut, which, by the way, we talk about blockage in your diet, eating things that are not digestible. That's what we mean by roughage. Is it just sort of a physical cleaning out, like a scouring pad is going through? Not so much. Maybe we are feeding them. Yes. It's a carbohydrate source that we're feeding the organisms that are in our gut. So we're walking around and we have to feed them. The whole idea of breakfast cereals and Kellogg and all that, if you're curious about history at all, that has to do with they were fixated on cleaning out their bowels and their gut. So we have to feed them. So it's almost like Matrix. You know? They are inside of us and they outnumber us, and we have to feed them, and we move them from place to place. They're like controlling us. It's sort of a scary thing. You know, we're just a necessary thing for them to survive on the face of the earth. So anyway, we've got these organisms. So who would have the same kind of organism? Who ate the same food as you did? Someone lives in your household. Their gut has all the organisms that you used to have because you ate the same stuff, whatever that was. Okay. So regardless of your nationality, and regardless of the foods that you ate, you're feeding a certain segment more than another segment, and therefore you have a certain balance and a certain presence of certain organisms. So what they did was, realizing they got a gut that's 3 days old, they took the fecal material from someone who lives in the household and gave them a fecal enema. They took the fecal material from the household contact and inserted it into the patient that had C. diff. Bizarre. But it was like 97% effective. Well, that's sort of crazy, but given the alternative, I mean, think about it. We got C. diff. What are we going to do? We're going to treat it with antibiotics, right? We're going to treat it with vancomycin because it still works. Okay, so we knock it back, and we get rid of it, right? Then we have a gut that's about 3 days old again, and they're living in the nursing in the rehab center. And what do you think they're going to get again? C. diff again. These patients get it again, and again, and again. If they get it twice, it's almost like 90% they're going to get it a third and fourth time. It's not like you can treat them with antibiotics and get rid of it, because the antibiotics will start the problem in the first place. Plus, we're down to using vancomycin, and that doesn't work, I know what we're going to do. So this idea of a fecal enema, as bizarre as it sounds, seems to work. And what began as a crazy thing up in Canada is now becoming, oh yeah, time to do it. Okay? It's not something that they want to say, no, this is a major medical advance for using a fecal enema. But go online and do some research on C. diff and find out what our problem is and find out how we're solving it. The problem was created by antibiotics and is not going to be solved by antibiotics. And we have to have a better appreciation of these gut bugs. And by simply sterilizing the bile to get rid of these guys, to prevent peritonitis, by heavy doses of antibiotics to prevent the problem in the HIV infection, we are actually setting up the patient for death. A death that can be prevented, or at least we have to learn why they're dying. And they're dying because the normal flora of the gut is taken away. So we need to put it back in there. Now, this has brought up a whole bunch of interesting industrial kinds of settings. There's always individuals trying to use medicine to make money. Some of them are good ideas, some are not. You may have heard of things like probiotics, or various kinds of things where we have organisms. One is called Culturella, I think it is. But we have organisms that are lyophilized, freeze-dried, in a pill form, and we give those to the C. diff patients. Now the problem there is that there's only one or two bugs there. We can take kefir, which is like a smoothie, but it's like a yogurt kind of thing. And there's maybe 8 or 10, depending upon variety, of organisms there. Either 10 are better than 1 or 2, but they're not 1,000. Okay. I mean, the fecal enema, that we were giving them a whole bunch of organisms and all varieties. So we're trying to start understanding about their guts, about that secession process, how we can get it to come back without using fecal enema, but how we can get the normal gut to come back. And we'll probably, over time, develop a series of compounds, organisms, that we're going to give the patient at different stages. We'll give them this, we'll give them this, and we'll give them that. Because ultimately, if we're not careful about it, we end up with fungal problems in these patients' guts, which complicates even more, and it just gets way out of whack. So we need to understand and appreciate the normal flora of the gut. We are not there yet. But we have to realize that they are not the enemy. That's the first step. And we're starting to realize that. The other part of this, there is a commercial value or commercial interest in providing nutritional source for the organisms in your gut. And you see some commercials. This lady's on one of those walkways in an airport, and somebody says, "Oh, you're the gut plug lady," or something like that. I can't remember what they call it. She says, "Oh, yes," and she pulls out some product that you can make. It's beginnings of an understanding, okay? That's not a solution. Acidophilus kinds of things, all of those yogurts and so on, they're the beginning of an appreciation that we have normal flora in our gut that we have to take care of. And by destroying them, we create problems. And we can solve problems by reestablishing those organisms. But again, the attempts, for the most part now, are feeble. We have 1,000 organisms and we're adding 1 or 2 or 3. But it's better than before when we thought they were all bad. So you will see C. diff, and it will be a problem, and you will see old people, people's grandparents and so on, dying of C. diff. And you're going to wonder, what can we do about it? Maybe back to this lecture today. And again, go online. It's really a fascinating story. It's an ever-evolving situation as to how we're dealing with it. But we're beginning to have a greater appreciation of the microorganisms involved. Okay, you can appreciate that we have a variety of microenvironments through the intestinal tract, through the stomach, which is going to have acid pH at the time, all the way through to the large intestine of the colon. And as we do with these microenvironments, we have different organisms growing. So the lactobacilli are found in the intestinal tract. Okay, so largely in the stomach. Enterococcus lactobacilli in the small intestine. And we'll also see some lactobacilli down all the way in the colon. So you see lactobacilli found in all three regions. We actually get into the large intestines. That's when we have enterobacter organisms. Enterococcus fecalis. You'll see this one, Enterococcus fecalis, becoming an increasing concern in nosocomial infections. This one we see an increase in antimicrobial resistance. So for whatever mechanism, this is a strep-like organism. It used to be Streptococcus fecalis, but we changed it into Enterococcus. So it's a gram-positive organism that's in chains. The cockle-shaped organism. But this organism is showing already signs of antimicrobial resistance. When it gets out of the gut and into the bloodstream, this strep organism or Enterococcus organism can grow on heart valves and cause some endocarditis and so on. So it's a bit of a concern, particularly because it's coming from the patient's gut and it's increasingly antimicrobial resistant. Bacteroides organisms, bifidobacteria organisms, Peptococcus organisms, Streptococcus organisms. You see all these various kinds of critters. Clostridium organisms and lactobacillus are all in this laboratory. So you have more organisms in the colon in terms of varieties. And this, again, is just a part of those 1,000 different varieties than we see in other parts of the intestinal tract. About 1/5, 20%, 1/5 of fecal mass is bacteria. A large number of bacteria moving on through. A little note about anaerobic infections in general. Most are mixed infections. Because if they're coming from the gut as a source, for example. But even in the case of gas gangrene, that was a mixed infection. It's not fully coming from the gut. If we look at, this is just one hospital's report on an annual basis, just to give us a sense of this, 20% of the bacteria is anaerobic. Almost 90% of brain abscesses are anaerobic. Bite wounds. Now, this is not only dogs and cats, but this is people bites. Okay. Friday night fights. Friday and Saturday night bar fights. People bite off whatever they can get into their mouth. And so we have people losing ears, fingers, toes, nose, lip. So the bite wounds can be affected by half the time with anaerobic. So it could be animal bites, and some are dogs and so on, but people bites are also in there. Pelvic inflammatory disease, PID. Okay, this is cervix on up in the fallopian tubes, can go to the abdominal cavity, pelvic inflammatory disease. Between a quarter and a half are anaerobic agents. Sinus infection, half the sinus infections are anaerobic agents. Dental abscesses, anaerobic agents. Now that's the dry socket when you get the wisdom tooth pulled, that's an abscess. When we talk about hot and cold abscesses, if it leaks out a lot and it doesn't build up pressure, it's called cold. Hot ones when it's hurting all the time. But those abscesses, which can be a source of organisms that get into the lung and so on, 94% anaerobic infection. Surgical wounds, head and neck, abdominal, you can see where they're coming from, obviously, the intestinal tract. Appendicitis, peritonitis, falling appendicitis, 96%. Ear infections, third to half. Lung abscesses. A lung abscess. You might think of the lung having oxygen, but this is a collapsed lung. Distal to the point in which it's no longer inflating in an anaerobic condition. And of course the diabetic foot ulcer, the classic diabetic infection, beginning with the ill-fitting shoe, the blister from playing basketball, the improperly cut toenails, and so on. STD, sexually transmitted disease. This is the last topic before the next event. When is the next event?
A week from today.
What's that?
A week from today.
So we'll see if we're going to sign. We're ready to do this time. We're not going to change it. We're okay with it this time? We'll find out probably a week from today. STD, sexually transmitted disease. General consideration. Older term venereal disease versus the current term STD. Venereal disease simply meant spread by and only by sexual transmission. And Venus being the god of love, the venereal. Okay. STD is an organism that may be spread sexually, but may also be spread by non-sexual means. Now, I just think of hepatitis B. You can get hepatitis B through blood and blood products, as well as sexual transmission. So that's an example of it, STD. So VD was narrow. STD is broader. Wide variety of organisms can cause STDs, and most often we see them as mixed infections. So we see bacterial organisms, viral organisms, fungal organisms, parasitic organisms. And we see them in the patient, we find one, we look for others. So it's bizarre as it may seem, if we find a teenager that has body lice, they may have gotten body lice by sleeping in somebody else's sleeping bag. But they may have got it in sleeping in a sleeping bag with somebody else in the sleeping bag. So as soon as we find one of these, we have to work on the assumption that it's a mixed infection, and we have to look at all the possibilities. So that may mean AIDS testing someone who's a teenager comes down with something that's possible. Okay? So mixed infections are the norm. First organism there, Neisseria gonorrhoeae, gram-negative organism. Diplococcal organism. There's two cockles, short chain cockles here. Let me say two, diplococcal. We've already seen this organism got eye infection from that story a little bit there. The organism has common pili, allows it to attach to various parts of the body, causing infections in those sites. We talked about comatillide, we gave you the site, but we'll give it to you again. The organism can cause infections in the conjunctiva of the eye. It can cause infections in the throat. It can cause rectal infections, lower GI tract. It can cause urethral-based infections in the male, urethra, etc. ascending into the prostate, epididymis. In the female, we have infections in the cervix and the fallopian tubes. As we just mentioned, we also get a pelvic inflammatory disease. So, anaerobic organisms can cause PID, but so can these sexually transmitted organisms such as bacteria and gonorrhea. It's all common dog. The organism does not spread throughout the body. It's put in these locations. So if you don't look in all the right places, you may miss the person who's infected. Once the organism attached to the epithelial surface, within 3 to 5 days, it penetrates into the sub-epithelial surface, sub-epithelial tissue, and it triggers a strong inflammatory response. Lots and lots of polymorphonuclear cells, or pus cells. Pus cells are easily identifiable in certain body sites, so you see it in the eye particularly. Okay. Or the male may have a urethral discharge. So when the male urinates, after the flow of urine, there'll be an ooze, a pus. Okay. That's not normal, and he may seek treatment. Likewise, the eye that we showed you before, that person will seek treatment. However, other areas of the body is asymptomatic. And that's part of the problem in terms of spreading from person to person. In the throat, it's a mild sore throat. In the fallopian tubes and cervix area, unless you're doing an up close examination, a pelvic exam, you're not going to notice it. The people will not have any discomfort at that point. And so there are, likewise, in rectal mucosa, that's not going to be noted. So there are body sites where you hopefully have it. Then allows it easily to spread to other people. Next time we'll talk more about it.